From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. By the way, welcome new affiliates in Kansas City, KMBZ 980 AM and 98.1 FM. Great to have you aboard, and it's great for us to be aboard. Next hour, we go to Egypt for the Giza prophecy. Here's what's happening. Now, there's an asteroid called 2011 AG5, and if it follows the orbit that scientists have plotted for it so far, there's a small chance that it could hit the planet in 2040. Now, don't quit your job, don't sell your house, don't panic yet. Astronomers who have been tracking this asteroid since January of last year say that with this orbit, it could get close to Earth in 2040. The asteroid appears to be 450 feet across. The problem is that having watched it for only about half an orbit around the sun, the scientists cannot say for certain where it will be 28 years from now. So for the moment, NASA's Near Earth Object Program says the odds are about 1 in 625 that it could hit us in that still distant future. Older generation full-body scanners deployed at the nation's airports are safe even for the most frequent travelers. That's according to the Department of Homeland Security's Office of the Inspector General. In a report, the agency says independent tests of the machine show that a passenger would have to be screened 17,000 times a year to reach the scientific community's assessment of the annual radiation dose limit. Now, that would be the equivalent of 47 screenings on each of the 365 days of the year. Israeli officials say they will not warn the U.S. if they decide to launch a preemptive strike against Iran. The Israeli officials said that they want to keep the Americans out of the loop in the event something occurs. A great primetime night for Mitt Romney, the primary winner in Michigan and Arizona. He landed a victory Tuesday night in his home state of Michigan, fending off Rick Santorum in the Republican presidential primary contest and preventing what really would have been a major upset for his campaign going into Super Tuesday next week. The former Massachusetts governor also won easily in Arizona, a winner-take-all election that will help Romney build his growing delegate lead. The candidate's back-to-back victories hardly locked down the race, but they help him get his campaign back on track going into Super Tuesday, where 10 states hold primaries and caucuses worth hundreds of delegates. They need to get to 1,144. A new study out of Harvard University shows that pasteurized milk products from factory farms may be linked to causing hormone-dependent cancers. It turns out that the concentrated animal feed operations model of raising cows on factory farms churns out milk with dangerously high levels of estrone sulfate, that's an estrogen compound linked to prostate and breast cancers. Attorney Jonathan Emord with us. Jonathan, so last week they're shutting down farms and farmers who are making non-pasteurized fresh milk, and now we hear this study about pasteurized milk. What do we do?
Well, we have to drink less milk, I guess. Cows in modern industrial dairies are kept pregnant and lactating 300 days a year, George, increasing their hormone levels by 33%. And pasture-fed cows, like the ones the farms are shutting down, are milked only through the first 3 months of a new pregnancy and have one-tenth the hormone levels present in modern industrial dairies. And these hormones, as you pointed out, are linked to testicular, prostate, and breast cancers. Estrogens in milk are far more abundant and bioavailable than other environmental estrogens and are directly linked to these kinds of cancers.
If you are a mother, a father, you buy milk for your kid, what would you do?
Well, if you're going to drink milk that comes processed from the store, you really should limit your milk to skim milk, and you certainly shouldn't be drinking whole milk every single day because of these hormone levels. Many of us were brought up on whole milk, and unfortunately, they're finding that there are these links. They aren't conclusive, but they're definitely troublesome when there's an elevation of some 33% above normal levels in these milk products, whole milk products, and cheeses as well.
Okay, Jonathan, thanks for that update. The Food and Drug Administration has raised safety concerns about the popular class of cholesterol-fighting drugs called statins, warning that patients taking the drugs may face a small increased risk of higher blood sugar levels and of being diagnosed with diabetes. The Federal Safety Agency said it plans to add the diabetes risk language to the warnings and precautions sections of the labeling for the statin drugs. The drugs that will get the warning include top-selling brands such as Lipitor, Crestor, and Zocor. Under these and a range of generic names, the drugs have been taken for years by tens of millions of people to prevent heart attack, stroke, and cardiovascular disease. Sleeping pills used by thousands of people in the United Kingdom appear to be linked with a higher death risk as well. The study compared more than 10,000 patients who took sleeping pill tablets compared to 23,000 other patients who did not take the drugs. In Indonesia, helicopters ferried food, phones, flashlights to more than 1,000 passengers and a crew stuck aboard a disabled cruise ship that was being towed through waters prowled by pirates. Those aboard the Costa Allegra, a sister ship of the cruise liner that capsized off of Italy last month, where 32 people died, faced more stifling days and nights before the vessel docks in the tropical paradise. Here's Kelly Sweeney, the good captain, with us. Kelly, tell me a little bit about this situation. Again, another disaster.
Ahoy, George, to you and all the Coast to Coast AM listeners. Well, this is, they had a fire in the engine room on this vessel, and it disabled the ship, and it was drifting in a high piracy area. Now, what brings this back to the Coast listeners who go on cruises, and what they need to be aware of is that the safety regulations that apply to cruise ships vary depending on the age of the ship. Now, the Allegra was originally built in 1969 as a freighter and was remade into a cruise ship in 92. And because it was built originally in 69, it is not subject to the same safety requirements and standards as new builds that are just coming out off the line right now.
Kelly, you know, over the last couple of days, we've had stories of cruise liners where people get robbed in Mexico. People have been sick. A couple ships, you know, people come down with strange viruses. What would you do if you were going on a cruise?
The awareness is the key, George. Regarding the passengers in Mexico, they were on a shore excursion when they were robbed. Now, the U.S. Department of State has issued a travel warning on February 8th for Mexico to all travelers. And some Mexican ports are so dangerous that cruise ships have stopped going there. What people need to be aware of, and in particular on in the Carnival Splendor, which these passengers were attached to, Carnival Cruise Line's website will show them that the company makes it clear it is not responsible for anything that happens to passengers while off the vessel. And that includes getting robbed, killed, or anything else, and all cruise lines have similar disclaimers. So any of the listeners who go on cruise ships need to be aware, and this is something that commercial mariners have dealt with for centuries. In every port in the world, George, there are people who know when certain ships dock.
That's right.
And they size up the passengers and crew as they're coming off the gangway and check out who looks like an easy target with a fat wallet.
Good point, Kelly Sweeney. You know, I had problems in Mexico a month or so ago and got out of there with my neck. Why do some people succeed and others don't? Whether it's wanting to get ahead at work, find a loving relationship, straighten out finances, or just simply to take better care of yourself. Why do some people succeed and why do others not? Up next, we'll be talking to Heidi Grant Halverson about that very question. Succeed, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Dr. Heidi Grant Halverson is a psychologist, a speaker, author, specializes in motivation and achievement. She is also the associate director of the Motivation Science Center at Columbia Business School and a very popular blogger for the Fast Company, Harvard Business Review, Forbes, Huffington Post, and Psychology Today. We're going to talk about her work, Succeed. Heidi, how are you?
Hi, George. I'm good. How are you?
Good to have you with us. You know, you're right. Why do some people succeed and others don't? No matter what they try to do, they just don't seem to make it. Why?
You know, a big part of the problem is that we tend to blame our failures on the wrong things. I think one of the things that's really fascinating about studying motivation is that it's really an area of our lives where our intuitions kind of let us down. The things that we think make someone successful turn out not to be the things that make them successful, and we blame our failures on the wrong things. Until we kind of get those wrong-headed notions out of the way, it's difficult to then try to figure out what's really going on. I think probably the single biggest mistake we make is really thinking about our successes and failures in terms of ability. And Americans do this probably more than anybody in the world. We kind of, you know, when we look at successful people, we tend to equate that success with having a lot of ability. And by that, we usually mean something like innate ability, like you won the DNA lottery, and so you have, you know, all the willpower and the intelligence and the creativity to be successful. And then other people are less fortunate; they didn't win the DNA lottery, and they don't have those things, and so they're not successful. And that turns out to be wrong. That kind of thinking about success as being a product of ability, in really two very important ways. One is that ability doesn't actually work that way.
Right.
Really, we know from studies not just of intelligence, but of other kinds of abilities like creativity, like willpower, like social skill, that really these abilities are all really profoundly malleable. That it really depends a lot on your experience and your effort, you know, how hard you try to sort of master these skills. So you know, if you don't have the ability today, you can get more tomorrow. And so it's sort of not fixed. You know, we have predispositions a little bit, but that doesn't say anything about where you can kind of end up. And the second reason it's wrong is that really, you know, more than anything else, it's what we do or don't do that really predicts whether or not we succeed. It's not sort of our fixed abilities. It's, you know, one of the things that was very surprising to me when I started studying motivation was learning that IQ tests and other kinds of standardized tests, the kind that we all take to try to get into college or whatnot, the ones that everybody mm-hmm. has to take nowadays, they do actually have a really remarkably terrible job of predicting success. I mean, not just life success, but just even just in the classroom, you'd think they could at least predict grades, and they really do a very terrible job. So to the extent that those things measure what we think of as ability, it doesn't really seem to make nearly the difference that we think it does.
Why do some people, Heidi, though, equate making money with being successful?
You know, I think that's very common, and unfortunately, I think it has a lot to do with the kinds of goals a lot of us end up pursuing. You know, there's a real temptation to pursue goals like money and fame and sort of validation, popularity, you know, these kinds of goals that give us what psychologists like to call extrinsic validation, right? Validation that comes from sort of outside yourself. They seem like they'll work. I mean, it seems like, you know, if I make a lot of money, I'll be happy. If people really like me, I'll be happy. It turns out not to really, I mean, you're happy for like a minute. You know, nobody's sad when they win the lottery, but that happiness doesn't last.
And then all the friends show up that you didn't
exactly.
have.
Right? It causes, for a lot of people say, it causes more problems than it solves. So you know, you're happy for a little while when you know, you make lots of money, but it doesn't last. And that turns out to have a lot to do with sort of what our real sort of basic human needs are. Psychologists like to argue about these things, but we can kind of all agree that people need, you know, belongingness. They need to feel like they belong to groups, to families, to have relationships with people. They need to feel competent, so they like to sort of, you know, use their knowledge and skills to do things and feel effective. And they like to feel autonomous. They like to do things that they find interesting and enjoyable and sort of reflect their own values and their own likes and dislikes. But if you pursue goals that satisfy those things, you actually get a kind of a lasting happiness, authentic happiness. The problem is with these extrinsic goals like seeking money and fame, you know, a lot of times we do that instead of pursuing the goals that would actually make us happy, and then we end up miserable, and we don't understand why. And so we think, well, the problem must be I just don't have enough money yet. And so you keep trying to get more money or keep trying to get more fame. And really, I mean, if you half of Hollywood seems very miserable. So clearly, clearly, you know, having a lot of money and a lot of fame isn't really necessarily making people happy. We got to have to kind of, again, this is one of these cases where you have to get those goals out of the way to make room for the goals that are actually going to give you lasting happiness.
Well, and I'm amazed at how some of these folks will make zillions of dollars and they'll be broke.
Well, of course, yeah, because they don't have, well, I mean, there's so many reasons for that happening, but a lot of the time they just don't have, they don't have any kind of self-discipline really with the money. There's no plan B, you know? It's like, well, of course I'm, you know, I'm really famous now and then I'm going to be famous forever and,
yeah,
and everyone's going to always love me.
And
there's
not a lot
of really kind of prudent thinking. And in the end, they're sort of more miserable than when they started. I mean, it's really unfortunate. Not that you can't be rich and famous and also happy, but it has to do with sort of where you're trying to find happiness. And the truth is everybody needs enough money to get by, but beyond that, money for money's sake just doesn't really. In fact, the studies that looking cross culturally show that in the United States and all over the world, sort of the beyond a certain point, the wealthier you get, the less happy you tend to be. Because people don't, when they have a lot of money, they tend to not savor the things that are really kind of special. That sort of ordinary people without tons of money do savor, like the, you know, taste of a cold beer or a nice meal, or, you know, like things don't seem as special because you can always buy more of them. And really, savoring is like a really big source of happiness for a lot of people.
I remember back in the early days of lotteries, a fellow in the Midwest won, and he, you know what he did? He stayed in his mobile home and he went out and bought a guitar. That's what he wanted to do, and he had won millions of dollars. And I think, you know, I think back and I go, you know what? That's pretty cool that he was able to do that.
It really is. It was really wise, and probably, I mean, and that's probably one of the few happy lottery winners there is.
Well, you're right. A lot of them go bankrupt. You know, they're miserable. They get hit up by family members and friends. They don't know what to do, and that's a show all by itself, isn't it?
It really is.
You've written a chapter in your book about how different cultures seem to do things differently, mm-hmm. beating Americans, by the way, in different standards and tests and success. How is that and why is that?
You know, I think this is, again, one of these things that I started studying in grad school, and I just thought, this is so fascinating that there's this perception that Asian students from East Asian countries like China and Korea and Japan, that they're sort of better at math and science than American students. And, of course, they do on these kind of nationally standardized tests when you compare across culturally. They do, in fact. They are.
They succeed.
For a while. They're beating our students. And you know, and a lot of the perception, I think, that people have is that sort of, well, Asians are just good at math. And that turns and again, it's sort of like, you know, in the that thought that it's like somehow that's innate, right? Like Asians are just born good at math. Nobody's born good at math. And that's really important because I hear all the time, I have heard this a million times in my life, people say, I'm just not a math person. And the truth is, there's no such thing as a math person. what is true is that some people like math, sure. You know,
some people like history.
Some people like physics.
Some people
like English, whatever. But there's no such thing as a math person. Math and science and other kind of complicated disciplines like that, what they take is long hours to master. It's actually difficult for pretty much everybody. And the difference between people who are good at math in the sense that they master it and people who don't is time and effort. And what Asians do differently that I talk about in this part of the book is really they don't, unlike Americans who kind of, we tend to, like I said, you know, we see somebody who's really successful and we say, you know, wow, that person's really smart. They're really gifted. We love stories about, I mean, so do I. I think it's fascinating of stories about really gifted people and prodigies. And, you know, we love to watch things like that. And so we explain everything in those terms. Asians actually don't do that. People in East Asia, they actually don't think that ability and any kind of innate ability predicts how well you'll do at something. They think it's all about effort. It's very based on sort of Confucian logic. It's like, you know, the harder you try, that's how well you do. And if you do really well, it means you try really hard.
But they seem to be more disciplined.
Well, I think it comes from, in part, there's a couple reasons why that's true. I mean, there is a lot of pressure. I'm not actually saying that in fact everything is better there, because I do think it's sort of well known that there's a lot of pressure on students to do very well in those countries, and that some of that pressure can be a little excessive, and so that it's not an entirely positive story, but on the other hand, some of that self-discipline comes from actually just simply believing, if I can, if I try harder at this, I can do better, which for the most part is true when it comes to math and science. So, you know, American students and American adults, we tend to give up on ourselves way too soon. You know, we try something and it's a little bit difficult and we think, oh, I must not be good.
Yeah, we get frustrated. Heidi, stay with us. We're going to come back. We're going to take phone calls with you. Also, we're going to talk about some mistakes people make when trying to reach that goal. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, here we are. You're listening worldwide tonight to Coast AM. We're with Heidi Grant Halvorsen, her book, Succeed. Heidi, how many people, you're a psychologist, most people want other people to fail. They don't want them to succeed. Why is that?
Well, you know, there's a couple of anytime you have a hard time with something, there's a couple ways to make yourself feel better. One is to improve on whatever it was that you failed on. But many times that's, you know, quite difficult. So the easiest way to make yourself feel better is to do what psychologists like to call downward social comparison. But that basically just means, you know, kind of enjoying other people's failure. And you think, well, at least I'm not as bad off as that guy. And that's very effective in the short term for kind of getting rid of the bad feelings. Unfortunately, it's not very good in the long term because you don't actually improve at all or learn anything from it. But it's really common. I mean, it's a basic kind of a, you know, especially when we're kind of down in the dumps, it's a decent strategy for lifting your spirit.
That's a good point. Now, you talk about a mistake, a number one mistake people make when trying to reach their goals. What is that?
Well, I think the big mistake that we've been able to see over, you know, thousands of studies at this point is that we just don't get nearly specific enough about what we're going to do to reach them. I like to talk about weight loss because it's such a common goal, and that 2/3 of Americans are trying to lose weight. And you know, we all sort of feel like this should be easy, right? Because it's not like everybody knows what to do. You know, eat less and exercise more and you lose weight, right?
So it's a simple formula.
Right? I mean, except somehow we don't do it. And so one of the real, you know, challenges that people who study motivation really are trying to focus on is kind of figuring out why it's so hard to get from wanting to do something to actually doing it. I mean, kind of bridging that gap. You know, we think it's about commitment, but it's really not. Most if you look kind of across studies, you find that about 50 to 80% of the time, depending on sort of the kind of thing you're talking about, people have plenty of commitment, and they fail anyway. So it's really not that we're not, you know, committed to what we're doing. But we just don't do it. One of the major reasons we don't do it turns out to be that we just don't get specific enough about the actions we are going to have to take. So if you have this weight loss goal, you think, okay, well, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to eat less. Or I'll be good. We say things like that to ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or I'll go to the gym more. You know?
Or New Year's resolutions. Those things drive me nuts, Heidi.
Yeah.
Because if you want a resolution, start right away. Don't put it off until the new year.
Yeah, there's really no reason to put it off through Christmas. And we make the same mistake exactly with New Year's resolutions. It's like, oh, well, this is the year. I'll get, you know, I'll lose weight. And then we kind of don't really think that through. Turns out that if you get very specific, so instead of saying I'm going to eat less, you have to really think about, well, how much less and of what? You know, and what are you going to eat instead? People say, you know, I'll work out more. Well, how many times and for how long? And you know, when and where are you going to do this? So we need to kind of break it down. You usually ramp up success rates by 2 or 3 times. If you just kind of break it down, don't say, when I go to the restaurant, I'll be good or I'll order something healthy. Really think about what does that mean? Like, you know, what am I actually going to do differently? What actions do I need to take? Very specific, like down to the level of the actual behavior. What do I need to do? I mean, it sounds like that's sort of a, you know, who wants to do that much planning? But the truth is, it doesn't take that long to do when you think about a goal you want to reach and you think about exactly what do I have to do in order to reach this goal. You take that time to do it, and you're immediately 2 or 3 more times likely to succeed just by doing that.
Heidi, is there a common denominator among successful people?
I think one of the common denominators is certainly that getting specific, and the other thing is also sort of seizing opportunities. I think a lot of times we kind of let moments that we could have been working on one of our important goals kind of slip through our fingers, right? Everybody who's ever wanted to lose weight or has said the sentence, I wanted to work out today, but I didn't have time. Right, and it feels when you're saying it like it's true. you feel like you didn't have time, but it's almost never literally true. What is true is that you had time, but that time, you use to do other things. And maybe those other things are important too. But we kind of miss chances all the time to take actions to reach our goals. One of the things I tell people all the time is, you know, and people, by the way, who are successful actually are really smart about this, because they figure out, they don't just make to-do lists. They make to-do and when and where lists. So it's this is what I'm going to do, and this is when and where I'm going to do it. Because, you know, a lot of people make to-do lists, and then they find that they're not very helpful, and the same stuff stays on your to-do list forever. And the reason is because you sort of figured out what you need to do, but you haven't really thought about when and where you're going to do it. And when you take that extra step, again, it just takes like a minute to do. Again, we see success rates skyrocket. And we've done these studies with 10th graders kind of going into their summer and wanting to study for upcoming SATs. And we've been able to show that just by asking them, you know, okay, where are you going to study and when, and having them think about that for a minute, that they study two and a half times. So, I mean, and you can actually see those results in their SAT scores. So it's incredibly powerful. Just these little things that, you know, I think most of the time, very successful people don't necessarily realize that this is why they're successful. You know, we don't always realize what we do right. But a lot of times it's these little things, getting specific, thinking about when and where to do things, that really make the difference between achieving our goals and not achieving.
All right, let's go to the phones here. First time caller, Russell in Wisconsin, welcome to the program. Hey, Russell.
How's it going?
Good. Go ahead.
First time caller. Well, first time I got through.
Well, good. Well, welcome to the show.
I listen every chance I get, but I'd like to say that, you know, sometimes succeeding is more mind over matter.
Mm-hmm. Explain.
Well, I guess, a doctor killed my sister when she was 13 years old.
What do you mean? What do you mean killed your sister?
He cut a 1-centimeter size hole in her abdominal aorta, and she bled to death.
Gosh.
And they couldn't find the bleeder.
So sorry to see. Now, what's that got to do with success, though?
Well, I'm getting to that.
Okay.
And then in 07, my mom died from cancer, and then and just about a year to the day to my mom's death, my dad killed himself.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my goodness.
And I'm scared to be successful because I don't feel I deserve to be happy.
Are you putting yourself down because of all these tragedies? Heidi, what does he do?
Well, I mean, you know, these are very serious.
They're horrible events.
I think they're beyond the kinds of difficulties that a lot of people have to deal with in their lifetime. I mean, I don't think that the solution for somebody who's been through that much is necessarily a simple one, but certainly, you know, part of the solution has to be kind of learning to recognize that, you know, bad things happen to good people and to people who, you know, it doesn't mean that you personally have anything to do with these things, or that they're somehow, you know, an indicator of what you're capable of, or they need to limit, you know, your feelings about what you can do. I think it's very common. We find a lot of times that people who are depressed, the people who lack self-confidence, that a lot of the reason that happened to them has to do with the way they sort of explain the things that happened to them in their lives. And we know that when you have bad things happen to you, that are, you know, whether they have anything, but they're no fault of your own, or whether it's because you made a mistake and something bad happens, that the people who sort of say, this happened to me because it's my fault,
they punish themselves.
I'm a loser. I'm the kind of person, the thing this happens to, we make what we call sort of global and attributions. We blame it on ourselves. That kind of thinking really sets you up for depression and low self-confidence. Through the right kind of therapy, you can actually learn to not think that way. It's really kind of a thought retraining, because the truth is it's not true. And so, you know, with the right kind of, it's called cognitive behavioral therapy, but the idea is to sort of basically get people to question the way they explain the bad things that happen to them, and to kind of offer a new explanation. Like, you know, maybe these are terrible things, but maybe that doesn't mean that I, you know, can't still be a happy person, that I don't still deserve happiness, that I can't still make something amazing out of my life. And it's basically a retraining process, kind of teaching yourself to think about your life in a new way. And it turns out to be very successful. It takes some time and you need some help to do it. And so it's not something you want to try on your own, but that help is out there.
Why does it seem that tragedies come in waves on people?
I'm not sure that that they actually do, but it often feels like they do because one tragedy, I mean, in this case, obviously that is tragedy in waves, but for in many other kinds of instances where we feel like we're just getting hit with one thing after another, that perception has a lot to do with sort of the fact that once you get hit with one thing, your defenses are a little bit down. You're already kind of in a bad space. And the next thing that hits you feels that much worse. And so it's often, that it feels like you're kind of getting really bombarded. But it's not really out of the ordinary. It's just that it feels that way because you get worn down. I mean, there's only so much people can take. And I think that kind of adds to that perception.
Chad, east of the Rockies in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, Chad, thanks for calling.
I appreciate it, George. Sure, I want to capitalize on a couple things here. I really agree with a lot of what she's saying. And I want to capitalize on one thing where I feel like, depending on the mentality of a person, whether low or higher, depending on the subject matter that's addressed, a lot of it depends on the will and the subconscious mind power and the kindness and gratitude and compassion of the person on the receiving end. Mm-hmm. For example, if you're dealing with someone who is on a lower mental spectrum of life and you might have a higher spectrum than that person, it's going to rely on your compassion, your gratitude, your existence, and your fundamental will to share and exist with people in life to what that person receives from you. Because they can only receive what someone shares with them because they are on the victim end every single time. So every single person they come in contact with, they only receive that person, that true person. Like if you're kind, compassionate person, they're going to know you as that. But because they're maybe have a mental handicap or whatever the situation is, no matter what the lower mental spectrum is, if you have a situation or a certain time or situation to take advantage of that person, it all depends on your will because they are complete victimized. They have no understanding of your mental manipulation. They have no understanding of what's occurring. They have nothing but love and kindness they're sharing. So for someone to take advantage of someone on that mental end of the spectrum, I think a lot of what that depends on is the mental and compassionate being of that person that's on the receptacle end.
Well, what do you mean, though, by Chad, when you say take advantage of? Because I'm not sure a lot of people would try to take advantage of somebody who
was inferior. Oh, George, you'd be surprised. On an average, everyday basis, there's people trying just to manipulate simple things like cigarettes. And a lot of people that are on these mental manipulation sites, they get checks from the government. And people know this. And on the first and whatever of every month, they receive checks. And if they have someone in their life who has mental predecessor over them and who can manipulate them to buy drugs, whatever, to benefit them, those people are victimized. And the government and all these other people have no idea this is occurring.
Hold on for a sec. Heidi, do you follow this?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit out of my expertise. I mean, I was going to actually disagree with, in general, I think the thing you're saying, I think it's actually, I would say is true even of kind of dealing with anybody, whether they're somebody who's, kind of in a state where they don't have as much, cognitive capacity or just, kind of dealing with each other. I think the qualities you're talking about being, you know, being kind and honorable with people and really kind of showing them the best you, no matter who they are, you know, that kind of stuff comes back to you. And again, we know that from kind of, you know, what, looking at human beings and how they interact with each other, that, you know, when you, there is some real truth to this idea that what you kind of put out there, you get back. When you go into a situation expecting hostility, you tend to get hostility back. When you go into a situation kind of open, you tend to get openness and kindness in return. And it is true that sort of, you know, I think that's something you could say is true for all of our interactions. We're kind of always better off being that better person, I think, no matter what the temptation. And sometimes it doesn't work out and people are jerks back to you, but, you know, but you can still feel good about who you were in that situation.
Well, Heidi, if you tell yourself, you know, you can't succeed, you're not going to do it, negativity, it's not going to happen, is it?
Well, if you tell yourself you can't succeed, I'm so glad you asked me this. If you tell yourself you can't succeed, no, it's not going to happen. We know, you know, probably the single best predictor of whether or not people succeed is whether or not they believe they will. And again, that's something we've known for about 50 years of studying this stuff, that really kind of believing in yourself is really the best predictor of success. And having said that, I think it's important to distinguish between that and sort of positive thinking and negative thinking. There's a lot of talk out there these days about the importance of positive thinking and banishing all negative thoughts. And I think that it's important to be clear that there's sort of more than one kind of positive thinking. There's the positive thinking that's sort of believing in yourself, and that's really important. That's really important for success.
Let's go to this
thing, I can do it.
Let's go to San Diego now. Lisa's with us. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you guys?
Good.
Good.
Good. I was just bottom lining my whole yearning for success, and I understand that for myself anyway, it's about not believing every one of my thoughts, because, you know, we're in our own heads and we have so many thoughts per day, and if I believed everything I thought about myself or everybody around me, then, especially if it's not my business, like other people's lives are not my business, so, but if I believed every thought, it would drive me into a depression, because, you know, I have to ask myself, is this true? Is this really true what I'm thinking about this? And then a lot of times I come up with, I don't know.
It's so amazing, isn't it, how often that's the answer. And that's a really great insight. I think that's absolutely true, that a lot of times, you know, a lot of thoughts go through our heads and a lot of them are wrong. And figuring out which ones to go by can be a tough process. But the first step is definitely examining them the way you're doing and saying, is this really true? Is there another way to look at this? Is there, you know, another way that I can think about this? And then really kind of trying to choose the thoughts that are kind and positive, you know, the thoughts that are going to keep you going forward and keep you motivated.
Heidi, if there's one thing you needed to change for people so they can at least attempt to succeed, what would that be?
I would say the big thing is really stop thinking that your abilities are innate. Stop thinking they're fixed, that you're born good at some things and not at others. Nobody's born good at anything. And it's really it's really true. And if you want to be better at something, you can. Just give yourself, you know, be a little patient. Hang in there. Give yourself time to learn it. You know, really, that's one of the big things that successful people do. They hang in there. They're not so hard on themselves. So we could all learn a little bit from that.
Succeed. Where do you get the book?
Anywhere books are sold. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere you want to go. And you can go to my website online, which is HeidiGrantHalverson.com, and you can also get links to the book.
Well, it sounds like you had fun writing it, huh?
Oh, I had a lot of fun writing it. It's great I wish I had this book when I was a teenager. I would have done a lot of things better. So it's really useful stuff. I hope people find it.
All right, Heidi, thank you so much. Up next, we're going to Egypt. We're going to talk about the Giza prophecy next on Coast to Coast AM.